Good evening, workshoppers. We've got a new episode of West March coming at you today. Back on the bi-monthly schedule, going back to the episode every other week. It's just me tonight, no special guests or anything along those lines. But we've got quite a few topics to go through and cover in tonight's episode. Namely, we've got some new updates from the Diablo 3 PTR. Some little tidbits of information have been continuing to spread out on the internet across interviews after or that were made during BlizzCon Line that are being re-released after. And I'm taking a bit of a deep dive into, you know, some of the lore and story implications that we learned from BlizzCon Online in the Rogue trailer that kind of tie into the original announcement of Diablo 4 and what could be going on in the world of Sanctuary. But let's go ahead and jump right into it, and welcome to episode 205, We're Going to Church. As you can probably guess, you know, where we're going to be talking about lore later on in the episode. But yeah, if, you know, first off, you know, as we went and talked about on the last episode with Dread and Leviathan, didn't really have too much of an opportunity to jump into it. There is, of course, the new PTR for Diablo 3. It's been out for a couple of weeks now. With some huge system updates for Diablo 3, where, you know, on one side, this is going to be a season that doesn't have, like, a special theme, because they're tying the seasonal theme into the core game, because they're making massive changes to, like, the core components of the game itself. I'm sure it's no easy task to go through and, you know, add additional item slots onto the follower, while at the same time making all those legendaries from the follower work on the your base character itself. We touched on this, you know, in the last episode, so I won't go into it too much, but it fills me with a lot of hope for Diablo 3, and that it's got a pretty bright future ahead of it if they're willing to go through and make some, you know, massive back-end system updates, such as this Emanate system for the followers, as well as completely overhauling the leaderboards. Especially, like, that leaderboard change is something that I know the community has been asking for, like Leviathan in particular, for quite some time, of being able to go through and say, you know, I really enjoy set XYZ, but it's non-meta, so I'll never make a placement on the leaderboards with it, but now I can go through and live my best Marauder's life, you know, and just have a full M6, no Natalia's anywhere to be seen. And, you know, go and compete on that level and see how I rank up with other players that are going and, you know, living the Marauder's life for Demon Hunters, you know, or, you know, the Pestilence set for Necromancers, or, you know, any of whatever your particular favorite set might be for any of the classes. And this is a great follow-up as well, you know, after we've had the new sets released for all of the classes. We've gotten some, like, little balance tuning and changes, you know, that we had with the last season. And now we're starting the year off with some big updates to kind of, like, the core of the game. And it's, you know, it kind of starts here. You know, what's next? You know they messed around with that, the fourth cube slot, and, you know, or being able to equip any type of item in any of the cube slots. And those are some of the things I wish and hope that they take some cues from Path of Exile, where when you have really popular seasonal content, that if enough of the community goes through and asks for it, that they end up adding it to the core game. I would love to have a fourth cube slot, you know, added into D3, or at a minimum, just, you know, unlock, untithe the cube slots themselves, instead of having to have a weapon and armor and a piece of jewelry. Let people have access to anything that they want. You know, some classes might get a little bit more out of it by being able to equip multiple weapons or multiple pieces of jewelry, but, you know, it's cool. It's fun. It's more player choice, more player agency, and it's been a, you know, common theme of things that the community themselves want from the franchise as a whole, whether it's just Diablo 3, Diablo 4, what have you. But, you know, since last episode, episode 204, they have done an update to the PTR, and while we don't have any news at the moment as to the end of the PTR or, you know, if there's going to be any further updates to the PTR itself, they have made some changes. Namely, you know, they're still honing in on the new rework of the Rathmas set. You know, and that is combined with not just the Rathmas set piece bonuses themselves, but then the supplementary items that were added to it in order for, like, that Bone Spirit... Excuse me. The Bone Spirit play. Namely, they've gone in... you know, made it, I guess, like, a bit more reliant upon Bone Spirit. The Army of the Dead, you know, is no longer going through and getting some of its supplementary bonus. You know, they changed the Bonds of Selena, which used to increase Army of the Dead and Bone Spirit damage by 300-400%, while it... you know, adding additional damage to Bone Spirit based on, you know, how many hits Army of the Dead had, like, within the last 5 seconds. Now it only increases the damage of Bone Spirit, and they put a cap on it of 500 stacks. Because that was one of the things that they were beginning to see on the PTR, is it was uncapped. And SVR has had many an episode of his particular stream where he's talked about the dangers of uncapped multipliers and the effects that that has on gameplay, and anything that does that is liable to break the game. See the Aegis of Valor Crusader, where that one, even though they've implemented caps, is still ridiculously powerful. But, you know, they've kind of toned down some of the damage. Army of the Dead can still be somewhat respectable and kind of like the Speed Clear build, but it's entirely focused around Bone Spirit. It's a little bit easier to play since you're, you know, you have like max stacks in order to play around with. But, you know, it's one that is, you know, it's kind of working. You know, it's at least it's kind of like a diversification of playstyle. You know, it might be great for like some speed builds and stuff like that, but we really are not sure which direction that developers might take it if they have any other further changes for the set. You know, they kind of did some massive reworks to Firebirds yet again. The most changed set in the game got changed again. Who would have thought? And, you know, they've also have gone through and are trying to address the damage of the Gears of the Dreadlands set a little bit by changing the functionality of the Ninth Series Satchel. So that way it no longer has, like, infinite pierces. They're capping the pierces on that set instead of capping it within Gears of the Dreadlands, so that way it's not affecting things outside of the GOD Demon Hunter build, but they're adding in kind of like a increased damage multiplier to the Gears of the Dreadland in order to make up for the bonus that was lost, you know, so that way it's one of those ones where it's like you're not having the infinitely piercing projectiles that of course is helping on some of the server side calculations and some of the issues that the set brings up on that place, but still is kind of, you know, reducing the damage of the build overall by limiting the number of pierces that Hungering Arrow can do. So, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting. And then also one of the other ones is that the Blackthorn's Jousting Mail, now they changed it to where the elemental damage is no longer a primary stat, but a minor one. So this is, you know, while it was nice to have that option before, so that way you didn't have to roll a Witch Doctor for the Swampland, you know, waiters, it now completely replaces the Swampland waiters in that respect, because you get one additional, you know, affix out of it. You're not taking up a primary slot for the elemental damage, you're just taking up a secondary. So, you know, it likely is still not going to make it so that way Blackthorns is going to be used in any particular sets, just because of the scaling that you could get out of, you know, say, using that extra set slot for Captain Crimson's or Ashara's, you know, or something along those lines. But it is still, you know, it was still a nice little bonus and a little leg up, leg up for, you know, lawn builds. There's all those changes. I'm gonna be interested in seeing if we will get another week of the PTR. You know, previously they had talked about wanting to go through and do like 2 week PTR cycles, but that would, you know, lead to an increased season length. And obviously with an update with the size of what it is that they're trying to do and the implications that that has on the back end, we're a little longer, we're a little past that. But, you know, maybe we'll see an end to the PTR sometime soon. Maybe we'll see another update for continued testing with how they go and they do things. It's nice, you know, at least getting the second week out of it, so that way we can see some of the changes that the dev team has had, because that was one of the big criticisms in previous patches, where they would have us test a set, they would make changes after the PTR closed, and then when we got into the actual patch, there was a completely different playstyle or problems that arose, you know, from the changes that they made. But now, you know, we're at least getting one round of changes to go through and address issues. But, you know, will they make further changes outside of the PTR, or, you know, or will we be able to test the actual final version of these items and playstyles that the devs have intended before it goes live in the game itself and before we start the season? And this will be one of those ones where we didn't even get to see what the seasonal bonuses are, because it wasn't implemented on the PTR, since it's, you know, the season as well as the core game are both getting these updates at the same time. But it will be interesting to see once that patch, you know, once the patch is finalized, maybe we'll get some cool little insights into the items that we're going to be getting, you know, by going and getting Guardian. Which also reminds me, is I still have one more conquest to do to finish out the current season in order to go and claim my rewards. But, God, I hope for the next patch that they go and they address conquests, because there are some, like this season's conquests were just terrible. I think I've dedicated half an episode to complaining about the season's conquests, so I won't go on, you know, with it any further. But moving on, you know, we've been getting some like little tidbits, you know, across the interwebs on the various Diablo projects that they have going on, as more and more outlets continue to release some of the interviews that they had with the developers, you know, at BlizzCon or shortly thereafter. And one of the more interesting ones is that just the level of dedication that the Diablo II Resurrected developers have to the game, and that they're even going to allow players to import their, you know, their offline save files. You know, so that way you can actually go and take your D2 character that you've been playing offline and have that file saved. And I've been seeing the Reddit clips, where people have been going through and sharing screenshots on Reddit where they have some files, you know, back from 2001 or something that they haven't played since 2005 or 2006, that's just sitting on their PC, you know, or they have a collection. I think one of my favorites was seeing the collection of floppy disks that they had all of their characters saved to, which is, that dates me a little bit, that when I go through and I can see the floppy disk, it's like, I remember those. That's how I learned on the computer, right? Ooh, makes me feel old. But, yeah, it's just little tiny things like that that are really trying to embrace the overall experience of Diablo 2 in Resurrected. And I think the game is going to be amazing, you know, but obviously the downside of it is I've played it already. It's D2, but with some shiny new graphics and some bug fixes. Like, please, no invisible poison clouds. Please. You know, and I'm going to play it. I'm gonna dig it. I'm going to absolutely love it when it goes through and comes out, but I don't think that I'm going to play it over, say, Diablo 3 or, hoping, Immortal. You know, since both those games are going to be slated for release in 2021, I do hope that we get D2 Resurrected before Immortal, so that way, you know, I can dedicate some more time to going and playing it. But I've been in a rut lately, and I don't know if you all have as well, but the only things that I've been wanting to play are Diablo 4, D2 Resurrected, and Diablo Immortal. And just, I can't. You know, I can't play any of those games. I'm looking forward to, like, the next rounds of testing, you know, and, you know, whatever forms of alphas that they have for them to, you know, hopefully have a chance to jump in there and try them out. But, yeah. You know, it's like, I'll go through, mess around with Diablo 3 for a little bit. I don't want to go through and gear this Demon Hunter to get a couple of sets, you know, put together for another couple of conquests. I'm almost there. I've got, like, the Shadow set together. I literally only need, you know, one more set in order to go and complete the conquest. But, man, it's just not the same. It's not going through and pulling that feeling. I've had some like hungering to play some D2 as well, but I'm holding off on that one because it's like my fear is that it really is, if it's just going to be the same exact game, I'm gonna scratch that itch too early. I'm gonna jump into D2 Resurrected and it's gonna, you know, lose a little bit just for the fact that it's like, yeah, I've been going through and, you know, playing with this game already. But I am somewhat conflicted with Resurrected, where I don't know if I'm going to want to roll an Assassin or a Necromancer first. I know coming from me, that's a bit heretical, because, you know, I love the Necromancer so much. But just the last couple of times I've played D2, I've been having a lot of fun rolling with an Assassin. It's just such a great playstyle, and I am looking forward to the Rogue in D4 so much. Just because, like, kind of like that fast-paced melee skirmisher playstyle is one of the things I absolutely enjoy about the D2 Assassin. The kind of like the pseudo martial arts build. One of my favorites was the Riftison, the Rift Kicker. You know, where you drop a whole bunch of points into a Dragon Claw in order to get that 6-frame kick, and you get the Rift Rune Word. So that way, you know, it's one of the fastest attack speed characters in the game, and you know, you have a really decent proc ratio, so that way you're just throwing out tons of twisters. You can cast Frozen Orb faster than sorceresses, since sorceress has to deal with a slight casting delay on Frozen Orb. But yeah, you just spam the screen with so many spell effects, and it's just beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I don't know. I guess it's going to largely depend on who I get wrangled up in order to play together with me. And that is one of the nice things, like with D2, you have the 8-player cap, so you can, you know, fit in a much larger party instead of just like the 4-player cap that you've got with Diablo 3. So you can get together like an actual, like a full-on party and get, you know, all of your friends together. That's going to make for a really cool Discord evening, and probably stream once the game itself actually comes out to go through and give it a proper test. But I am looking forward to it. And of course, you know, Immortal, that's probably going to be like the Diablo game for 2021, in my opinion. You know, not to say that, not to diminish anything, you know, D2 is, you know, a classic, a legend, not just in the franchise but in the genre. It helped define ARPGs into what they are now. You know, everything, you know, tries to recreate D2, you know, and then make some twists on that, from like Last Epoch, PoE, you know, Grim Dawn. They all go back to D2 and the, you know, the systems and mechanics that it, you know, pioneered, you know, in the genre, in order to try and recreate that experience. So it's, you know, hats off to that. But yeah, Immortal is going to be the next big thing in the Diablo franchise while we wait for 4, and it can hold its own. Like, being able to play in the technical alpha and not having to, you know, not having access to the in-game content just yet, but they're going to have like mass PvP raids and other things. It's going to be so cool. I can't wait for the next round of testing. We'll be able to test out one of the next classes. Hopefully it's the Necromancer first. You know, totally unbiased want there. But it's going to be cool. It's going to be good. But I guess we kind of wrapping up the news throughout the community there and going and jumping into a topic I've been wanting to discuss, you know, ever since the first couple of frames from the Rogue reveal over at BlizzCon Line. Now, this is one of those ones where it's an image that we've seen teased in the past. Because you've got the opening where you've got the lovely, stained glass window, you're in the church, and you've got this kind of bold, blood red cross, you know, there. And it's something that we saw going all the way back to the Diablo 4 announcement trailer, where you have the little stone cross sitting outside that abandoned town that the group was unfortunately led down into in order to summon Lilith back into our world. And it's just like, you know, it sets such a tone going through and getting it. And, you know, looking around the internet and such, and it seems that pretty much everyone is kind of in agreement that this is like the new symbol for the Zhakarum. And that they're going in, that this is kind of like the parallel for the Church of the Zhakarum for Diablo 4. Whereas I can't find any actual source of Blizzard confirming it, that this is the actual symbol for the Zhakarum. I mean, it fits. When you go through and you look at it with the D4 announcement cinematic, the priest has that symbol on his tunic. You know, and he's going through, he's praying to Akarat in the light. You know, which Akarat is the founder of the Church of the Zhakarum. And just exactly who or what is the Church of the Zhakarum? It's kind of like your stand-in for Christianity in the world of Diablo. This is the major religious, party within the world of Sanctuary. It is, kind of like been there in the background ever since, Diablo 1. Had some references to the Church of the Zhakarum. King Leoric himself, when he went and made Tristram, his seat of power, was put in place there in order to try and bring the influence of the Church, back to the Western continent. And even like the Paladins from Diablo 2, they are the Knights of Westmarch, and they are a former sect, of a military arm from the Church of the Zhakarum that broke away from the Church, went west in order to go through and join Westmarch in order to try and get away from, some of the things that they perceived as wrongdoings or corruption within the Church. And then going even further, you have the Crusaders from Diablo 3, which, were founded because they knew that there was something dark at the heart of the Church of the Zhakarum, and they created this elite order in order to try and find the source, root it out, and purge the Church of all of its wrongdoings. This is a common theme that's been brought up, within Diablo, the corruption, the darkness, how you can't trust anything. And it definitely goes and plays into that kind of like that theme and that aesthetic. Because when you look at the Zhakarum, it was something that was created by Akarat. And the actual timeline of Diablo, to continue on that kind of religious parallel, the timeline in Diablo, the year zero is when the faith of the Zhakarum was created by Akarat. You have the Anno Kejistani, kind of like, the BC and the AC era and all those other types of stuff. It's kind of funny, those parallels. And Akarat himself, of course, kind of like, maybe not necessarily kind of like the Jesus stand-in, but as the prophet that, he had the vision of the Zhakarum that was handed down to him by an angel, and he went to bring those tenets out to the larger part of the world. But for the longest time, it was just a small little religious order and really didn't come to prominence around like a few centuries before. This is something that, the Zhakarum were, even at the time of, like, say, like the Dark Exile, when the Haradrim were going through and hunting down Mephisto Baal and Diablo, the church was still just kind of a relatively minor, you know, kind of like religious organization. But then it really began to come to prominence just, you know, shortly thereafter, where you had just a few hundred years later, and the church is now one of the de facto powers. You know, it's probably the most powerful political organization that existed over on the Western continent. And while it, you know, vied with Westmarch on the Western continent, they, you know, sending Leoric and having the Kingdom of Condurus, you know, had them a definite, you know, kind of like a banner that they planted in the sand in order to claim some territory over there as well. But it was flawed, you know, kind of like, you know, from the get-go. It was, the Zakarum, well, I guess let me start over a little bit there, going back to the Dark Exile, which was only about, you know, 300 years prior to the events of, say, you know, Diablo 3. And during the Dark Exile, the first of the prime evils that the Haradrim hunted down was Mephisto, the Lord of Hatred. And they hunted him down on the Eastern continent and defeated him, and then entrusted the Soul Stone that he was imprisoned in to the small little fledgling religion, the Zakarum. They saw them as, you know, tenants of the Holy Light, you know, basically the followers of, you know, guidance, you know, from the high heavens, something that the Haradrim, they themselves were doing. They were warriors of the light, you know, given kind of like their motto and their creed directly from Tyrael. And so they saw a bit of resonance in themselves, you know, with the Zakarum. And so they thought, you know, who better to entrust, you know, this prison of one of the most powerful, most evilest entities in all of creation than to them. And so they hand over Mephisto's Soulstone as they go and they travel across the Twin Seas to go and hunt down Baal and Diablo. And it's from there that the Zakarum, you know, would later, you know, form the city of Kharast, begin to expand their power base, and become a true, you know, worldwide power. But at the same time, Mephisto is working his way out of the Soulstone and into the mines of the, you know, the controlling enclave of the church, until, you know, just a few decades later, and the, you know, the Zakarum now is basically an extension of Mephisto, and he's in control of them, while on the outside everything looks nice and normal and people are praying to the light and everything is all nice and good. You have blood sacrifices and all these other great dark entities, demon summonings and such that are happening by the priests of the highest order in the Zakarum. So once Mephisto kind of like completes his power grab, you know, he's going through and sending out major players in order to try and find where his brothers have been buried and hidden. You know, he sends Leoric is basically sent out to Condurus under the guise of going and expanding the power base of the Zakarum. But he's, you know, he's sent along with the Archbishop Lazarus, who Lazarus knows the true nature of the Zakarum and is a follower of Mephisto, with the express purpose of hunting down Diablo's Soulstone. You know, and so this is kind of like where you get the whole, you know, corrupted religion theme that exists within Diablo, where you have the what should be the pure and holy religious organization is actually just dag nasty evil from the inside. And that is one of those things that could definitely tie into this, you know, this church, you know, the symbols that we've been seeing in Diablo 4 being part of the Zakarum, because who else would put a giant demon summoning chamber underneath a church, you know, if it wasn't, you know, a church that's actually controlled by the Lord of Hatred and Ruler of Hell? I mean, it just kind of makes sense, right? And, you know, it's not just, you know, that level of it, but, you know, not a lot of people were privy to who exactly Lilith was, you know, or where she was sent to. Even though Lilith was in control of, say, the Church of the Triune, which was the, you know, the Prime Evil's first, their first try at going through and taking over Sanctuary, you know, and using religion as a guise, they had the Church of the Triune, where you're praying to the different aspects you know, or, you know, kind of like the camouflage guises of the three, you know, prime evils. But, you know, was eventually found to be a fraud and thrown down by a fledgling order of, you know, newly awakened Nephilim called the Iridim. But for a brief period of time, when Lilith had, you know, regained her access to Sanctuary and freed herself from the Abyss during the Sin Wars, she got control of the Church of the Triune while she was posing as her brother, Lucien. And, you know, it could be said that maybe it was during this time, you know, she set up, you know, some sort of way to, in order to call herself back, you know, should she be imprisoned by Inarius again, if she should lose her gambit, and that, you know, some of these symbols that we've seen are actually kind of like a resurrection of the Church of the Triune. Because we saw in Diablo 3 that there was kind of some resurrection, and we had the Triune cultists and stuff that were going through and coming back, that maybe, you know, in the aftermath of Malthiel's attack on Sanctuary, they're trying again, you know, in order to get people to, you know, lure people into praying to the prime evils under the guise of a, you know, a beneficent religion. You know, and that she had just had this, you know, old temple hidden away, but it doesn't quite line up with that one. But with it being an actual church, you know, of the Zakharum, it would. If they were high up in the hierarchy of the Zakharum, they were literally being controlled by Mephisto. And we know from the Sin War trilogy that Mephisto was bitter about the banishment of Lilith to the Abyss from Inarius. And that's why he took Inarius as payment for the truce of Sanctuary, you know, kind of like as he wanted to make him pay, you know, for the loss of his daughter. Yeah, but even then, it would be kind of like to raise the question, if this thing was created just, you know, by Mephisto and the Order of the Zakharum like a couple hundred years ago, I'm sure they would have had people that were willing at the time, you know, in order to go and be blood sacrifices in order to open that gate. Why was it never used when the Zakharum were at their height of that power under Mephisto? You know, why was it being waited, you know, and abandoned until now? There's definitely some questions that remain unanswered in that respect. And it is, you know, some of these things that makes me wonder, because Blizzard themselves have never actually said who the symbol belongs to. It's just kind of like the running theory that, oh, it's obviously the Zakharum. But, you know, it's the same church that has this as its wall mural. You know, that's not a very holy image with a picture of a whole bunch of demons, you know, going through and fighting. You know, there's not really anything symbolizing angels, you know, within that. It's just some demons going and landing upon and preying upon some people that are going through and fighting. And it's definitely got some sinister tones to it, that it's this very well could be, you know, the Zakharum just never were truly purged of their corruption by Mephisto. You know, we saw a little bit of what was going on in Diablo 3. You know, it took place 20 years after Diablo 2. And the Church of the Zakharum was kind of like in shambles when it was revealed that the church was corrupted. Though it wasn't really revealed to the extent that the Zakharum was corrupted. It's like your normal person wouldn't be like, oh yeah, the Zakharum, they're the guys that were led by hell. No, they're just, you know, it's like, oh, there was some, you know, evil afoot and stuff like that. They managed to still hold on to some political power. You know, they kind of like, they were kind of holding on to Chaldeum, and they had, you know, some higher ups, some still remaining higher ups of the priests of the Zakharum that were, you know, responsible for picking the emperor and by nature the politics of Chaldeum. And so they still had some play, and they've mentioned in the Diablo 4 materials that they've released so far that the Zakharum is still one of those major players, and that's been vying for political power in, you know, in Sanctuary in the aftermath of Malthiel's assault. Which is one of those other interesting takeaways, is that they did mention, know, just how many people died during, you know, the events of Diablo 3. And they said, like, 90% of all of humanity was wiped out by Malthiel, you know, during the events of Reaper of Souls. That's a lot. You know, that is like pure, like, post-apocalyptic fantasy genre right there. You know, we always have these post-apocalyptic scenarios that take place, like, in the future or in sci-fi, and where, like, you have these high-tech worlds that fall back on, like, these medieval fantasy tropes and such. We've never really seen what happens to a fantasy world that goes through a post-apocalyptic scenario. And, you know, so that's one of those ones where I'm kind of interested to see how far they take that, how far they go with it, and going and creating this landscape of Sanctuary for Diablo 4. But, you know, it still is, you know, who is it, you know, that is going through and summoning Lilith? What's their end game? Especially when you go and you look at, you know, the rest of that Rogue trailer, where you have this... let me pull up the image. I forgot to go through and load this one here. But you have even just like the rogue, you know, going through and like delivering ears, you know, to the priest. And he's got like some sinister, you know, overtones, you know, about him going through and talking about how, you know, you might be, you know, a murderer and a thief, but you answer these people's prayers. You know, you know, it's like, he's also asking her, is the job done? So he's sent, you know, the rogue out to go through and murder people. You know, so it's just like, what's going on here? There's definitely something afoot. There's something going on and happening with, you know, this not just this character. But also, let's see, there we go. You have the character of the priest, and, you know, how it's going and tying into just like this kind of like this theme of darkness and corruption and such, where you still are working with the corrupted, you know, Zakharum priest and such. And one of the other things I kind of like noticed in the trailer was the box that the priest was placing all of these ears in. You've got, you know, on the outside you have this, you know, like praying maiden, and on the sides of the box itself you have these maiden statues that are pierced many times, you know, by spears. But then when he opens it up in order to go and place the ear itself, on the inside of the box, you see the same maiden, but now is, you know, holding a dagger. You know, and so you got this, you know, you got this kind of like this dual imagery that there's definitely something hidden. There's something sinister that's going on, you know, behind the scenes. Yeah, that there, everything that they did was finely crafted to go through and make you think that there's something more at play, with, you know, this religious figure, these religious symbols and such. And how does that play into, you know, Lilith's summoning? You know, because there could be some things where you have a couple different organizations, you know, within the rogue class. We know that there's going to be some class quests, and that you have your three different specializations that you can spec your rogue and swap between as you play the game, and that there's a little bit of a lore tie-in to these specializations that you have to experience as you go throughout the world. Could this church be one of them? But if they are, then what does that mean with the Lilith summoning? You know, we just don't know. It doesn't seem likely that it has an actual tie-in to like the rogue class, but then was that scene, you know, crafted just for the announcement trailer? Is it an actual, you know, in-game cinematic that we're going to get when we play Diablo 4? We'll be able to go and look like, oh, hey, you know, I remember this scene. Everybody gets to re-experience the sound of the ear yet again. I don't know. I don't know. It's tons and tons of questions. I really wish that they would just come out flat out say, oh yeah, this is the Church of the Zakharum. You know, or say that it's not. It definitely fits. It definitely jives. It is one of those ones where probably one of the most believable timelines of, you know, Mephisto, you know, the prime evils are always vying with one another. They're always going and trying to play the long game. You know, and if everybody had their own little, you know, subplot and scheme when it came to taking over Sanctuary. You know, part of the whole reason that they had the Dark Exile was Diablo, Mephisto, and Bale were trying to figure out a way that they could go and corrupt the souls of humanity because they saw the potential and the power that resided in humans because of their Nephilim heritage. And when they found out that you know, Heaven had forged these soul stones, these shards of the world stone, that they thought that maybe that they could corrupt these and use it as a key to bind the world stone in its essence to their being and kind of end the eternal conflict by getting permanent control of the world stone. And, you know, Diablo had a subplot there. Like, he figured that this wasn't going to work, or that he could have a way of, you know, kind of like having a way out to one up his brothers and take control of everything. And that's where you got the storyline for Diablo 3, where while he was imprisoned, when he was being released from the Red Soul Stone, you know, reached out and called to Adria, who then came out to Tristram and became, you know, his loyal follower. And, you know, she enacted his plan of going through and completing the Black Soul Stone and using it, you know, as a means of going through and merging, you know, the souls of all of the great evils together to reform as the Prime Evil, kind of an avatar of Tiamat, which, of course, would place him in control of all of that power, you know. And Bale, not so much. He didn't really seem to have any plots or schemes. You know, obviously there was the whole subterfuge of hiding Bale's soul stone so that way he could go through and enact the plan of the three brothers to take over the world stone. But he was in it, you know, for the destruction. And that was something that we even saw in the Book of Adria, where when Adria was enacting the rituals in order to pull in the souls of the dead prime and lesser evils, that, you know, Undariel fodder, Duriel fodder, Mephisto was one of the ones that, you know, scared her to her soul, you know, with how much that he fought back, you know, against, you know, being imprisoned within the Black Soul Stone and seeing that he had been duped this entire time. But Bale went quietly. Once Bale was going through and she was starting the summoning ritual in order to catch his soul floating around in the abyss or the ether and bring it into the Black Soul Stone, and he realized what was going on, you know, he freely went because he was enticed. She felt as if he was looking forward to just what type of destruction and chaos that this little scheme of hers and Diablo's could potentially rot. You know, as long as the people were screaming, things were burning, and that there's the potential to, you know, to break down Sanctuary or, you know, kick down the doors of Heaven, he was game. He was on board 100%. And so he didn't really have anything else going on, but it would, you know, Mephisto was one of those ones that was always kind of like, you know, labeled as like the leader of hell, as the most, one of the most forward thinking, you know, of all of the great evils. And that the reason why he was so powerful and was able to kind of like claim that de facto leadership, despite, you know, being the oldest brother, was that he constantly manipulated everybody into fighting amongst themselves, so that way they were always too busy to really be a threat to him or his own power base within, you know, the hierarchy of hell. It would make a lot of sense for Mephisto to have enacted his own contingency plan, you know, in case things went south, by having this like backup thing where he could go through and summon his daughter Lilith. And something I've talked about on the show before, that the two beings in all of creation in the known universe that were most attuned or adept to going through and manipulating the World Stone sans Odysseon was Anarius and Lilith. You know, yeah, Mephisto was already, you know, in possession of Anarius, and he wasn't going to be going through and doing anything. You know, Mephisto had Anarius locked down in his own realm in Hell, where he's been being tortured, you know, for over 1,000 years now. But Lilith was lost out in the abyss. And she would be the only other being that would be capable of potentially manipulating or using the World Stone to a degree that would give Hell an advantage, you know, in the renewed eternal conflict, should, you know, the Primeval's gambit of taking control of it failed. You know, or, you know, it could also be one of those ones where it would give Mephisto a trump card, should their plan even succeed, and there was Baal didn't want to give up or relinquish some of the power of the World Stone, and decided to that Baal was going to be the one that's in control of everything, and that he was going to lead Hell now. Mephisto, I'm sure, would not stand for that. Going through and pulling out Lilith in order to try and manipulate or take control back of the World Stone would be a very, very Mephisto-esque plan. You know, that's something that makes sense. And, you know, obviously these things never came to pass because they were beaten. They were defeated. You know, the Zacharum was broken, and any of the people that might have been there in order to enact Mephisto's plan or his backup plan were, you know, soundly defeated and destroyed. The World Stone itself was destroyed, you know, after the events of Diablo 2, and, you know, so there's really no reason in order to go through and call Lilith back. But now we do. We also know from that BlizzCon line that the PvP zones are being called the Fields of Hatred because they've been infused with the power of Mephisto. So Mephisto's essence is, it's around the world of Sanctuary, and it's, you know, it's having an impact known. The evils are about. The evils, these demons and such, they are truly immortal. We don't know entirely what the whole resurrection process for them is like. We're being teased with some of that information with Diablo Immortal, and we'll hope to see some more of it there. But we don't know, is it something that takes, you know, a couple of years, a couple of decades, centuries, thousands of years? You know, the Eternal Conflict has been a timeless, you know, war that's being fought between Heaven and Hell. And so it's one of those ones that could just be, you know, it could take thousands of years for the souls of these greater demons in order to go through and reform. You know, but because of some, you know, interactions between the Black Soul Stone, the World Stone, and the cultists and such, that they're able to, you know, be brought back sooner, you know, rather than later. We are going to just have to wait to learn more about that one. But we have seen, you know, from some of the little gameplay tidbits, that, you know, Duriel and Undariel, you know, are back in the game. So it wouldn't be too much of a surprise in order to see, you know, Belial or Asmodan potentially make a return. And you can't really have a game called Diablo without Diablo being in it, right? At least in some shape or fashion. So I imagine that we haven't seen the last of the three either. But it does make me think, you know, that this whole Church of the Zacharum, the resurrection of Lilith, and all of these things have something to do with Mephisto, or at least some machinations that he laid in place that maybe someone else has, you know, taken for, you know, their own means. You know, what if this pale cultist is actually, you know, working for, say, Baal or Diablo, and just came across, like, these old, you know, plans, you know, or this old scheme of Mephisto's, and decided to enact it, you know, in order to empower Diablo, you know, or Baal, or one of the other, you know, Lords of Hell. There's a lot of layers, you know, that could potentially go through and be on that one. And so, of course, these are questions we're never going to get answered until the game itself is out, but it's fun to go through and theory craft on it a little bit and have kind of charting a little bit of a course to where we could potentially be going, or some you know, theory crafting of lore, as it were, with the story. And you know, I hope that you've enjoyed listening to me rant, you know, about some things that I enjoyed from BlizzCon line that I don't really see a lot of people going and talking about, as we discuss, you know, lore and story here on the Westmarch Workshop. I think it's going to be a more regular piece as I go through and jump into the things that I enjoy about the franchise, with so much news and stuff going through and coming on. It's hard to compete, you know, with the likes of, you know, Riker, Bloodshed, you know, Lord Fluffy and such when it comes to, like, builds and theory crafting and the meta and gameplay and such. So I'll focus on the things that, you know, I enjoy, that, you know, that I can go through and bring in order to enrich or better the community, you know, from my perspective. And, you know, with that, it's going to go through and bring me to the end of the episode. And so if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please feel free to drop me a line over at westmarchworkshop@blizzpro.com. Again, that email address is westmarchworkshop@blizzpro.com. You know, or you can find the show on Twitter over at the WM Workshop in order to go through and see when we're going to have the next episode or when I go live. You can also follow me on Twitter at NineBallGamer. You know, we stream the podcast every other Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific over at twitch.tv/BlizzPro. You can also find me on Twitch. You know, I stream once a century, you know, over at twitch.tv/NineBall. I might actually stream a little bit this weekend. I'm taking some time to myself. I'm taking a little vacation from work. So I'll actually have some free time that I might be able to dedicate. But no promises. No promises. I know Longshot's going to hold me to it anyways. But until then, I appreciate you going through, tuning in, and I'll catch you all next time.